You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 21st, 2009, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hello, Governor.
And Evan Bernstein.
And on this date, today in 1677, the first medical book was published in the United States.
What medical book was that, Evan?
A pamphlet concerning the smallpox disease.
Fascinating.
Isn't that incredible? I hope they get that cured sometime soon, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's only been 330 years.
No, we'll be getting rid of that any moment now.
No, but they didn't have autism back then.
Yeah, they didn't have any of the diseases they hadn't discovered and named yet.
Isn't that incredible?
Right.
So, Rebecca's in London right now with Sid.
I'm in London, yes.
And that's why she said hello with an English accent, and I had to respond, because I'm like, you know, Pavlov's
dog. I was
really
just goading you.
I know. I can't help myself.
So how are our fellow skeptics across the pond, Rebecca?
I think everyone on this side of the Atlantic is fantastic, and it's been a really great week so far. I did London Skeptics in the Pub on Monday, and that was fantastic. I saw a lot of Skeptics Guide friends and guests that you guys know, like Simon Singh was there, and John Ronson, who we haven't had on the show yet, but we will. He's my super best friend, and he's awesome. Tim Minchin came, and he was a lot of fun. Great musician, and Ben Goldacre was there. You guys met him at Tim.
Oh, yeah.
Ben. Oh, cool.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I miss you guys, though.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we missed you last week.
I was really bummed to miss last week, because I didn't think I was going to be able to make it this week, because, I mean, it is 2 a.m. right now here in London.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Can we all just stop and think about the great sacrifice I'm making for you all by being on the show at 2 a.m.
All right, that's long enough. So, Bob, you got the first news item this week. Tell us about the holographic universe.
Oh, God.
Yeah, Jay and I did some preliminary talking about this. This one is really fascinating. I had a really good time researching this. But hold on to your beanie hats with the propellers on them. This one's pretty wicked.
I'm sorry, Bob, I don't have my beanie hat with the propeller on it, so can I hold on to something else?
Yeah, just put your hand on Sid's face right now.
Rebecca, what does your beanie hat have on top of it?
I can't say on a family podcast.
Okay. Use your imagination.
Well, scientists may have actually detected the grain of the universe. This may mean that our reality, everything we see and do, our entire universe, in fact, is like a three-dimensional holographic image of sorts projected from somewhere else. Talk about a 1-2 punch. This one was very, very interesting. The whole story starts with a German-British gravity wave detector called the GEO-600 in northern Germany. They've been trying to find for 7 years Einstein's theorized gravity waves, and they haven't found them yet, but they've run into a relatively big problem. Their detector keeps getting this background noise that will not go away. They've tried every way to rule it out. There's this subtle background noise that's been plaguing them.
Bob, did they turn the fan off?
Yeah, right.
Don't!
At this point, Craig Hogan enters a picture. He's a physicist at Fermilab Particle Physics Lab in Batavia, Illinois, and he was recently appointed as the director of Fermilab Center for Particle Astrophysics. He's been thinking about this really interesting principle called the holographic principle. It's a little complicated, but the idea is that the total amount of information or entropy that a space can contain depends on the surface or the boundary of that space and not the volume of that space. You see what I mean? So as an analogy,
yeah.
Think of the plastic used in a beach ball being directly related to the amount of information inside the beach ball. So it's not the volume of the beach ball that matters, but there's a relationship between the surface on the outside and the inside. There's a direct, almost a one-to-one correspondence.
That's a little counterintuitive, but maybe I'm sure there's some mathematical reason for that.
Well, you nailed it exactly. The mathematical principle actually works extremely well with the entropy of black holes. In 1972, a physicist, Jacob Bekenstein, discovered that a black hole's entropy, or information content, is proportional to the surface area of the event horizon, which is essentially the holographic principle.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here is that the progenitor star, the star that exploded to become that black hole, all of the information about the three-dimensional structure and everything about that star is encoded in the two-dimensional event horizon. So that's basically the idea of this holographic principle.
What?
In the 1990s, two other physicists, you got Susskind and de Hooft, they extrapolated this whole principle from the black hole's event horizon to the cosmological horizon of the universe. It's essentially the boundaries of our observable universe. So they kind of extrapolated it to the entire universe. So this would mean that the universe could essentially be described as a two-dimensional construct embedded in the boundaries of the horizon of the universe.
I don't get this at all.
Okay, let me just continue this thought then. So then our visible universe can then be seen as a three-dimensional representation of processes that are happening on this two-dimensional surface.
Is the universe in three dimensions or not?
Well, I mean, some people will say that the three dimensions can be kind of it's an illusion, and the reality is that you've got this two-dimensional surface, and we're just a projection. But it's real enough. It's real enough to me, and there's still way, way too much that we don't know about this to really come to any firm conclusions. The hologram analogy, it's not perfect, but it does help. Think of a hologram on your credit card. It's basically a piece of plastic with a two-dimensional pattern etched onto it. When you shine light on it, a 3D pattern emerges. So that's kind of what's happening with this holographic principle. There's a few more steps here, so bear with me. This one is a little more nasty than usual. So now we're back to Hogan. One of his keen insights here was that he realized that if this principle could be applied to the universe, then each tiny bit of our horizon would be linked to somewhere inside, right? Now, the tiniest bit of anything anywhere allowed by quantum theory is called the Planck length. Have you heard of that? That's the smallest conceivable thing that could exist. It's 1.6 times 10 to the minus 36 meters. That's about as small can get. There's no conceivable way.
Yeah.
There's no conceivable way to examine the universe at this scale. It's 100 billion billion times smaller than a proton. Really, really tiny. That's the fundamental unit of length or grain allowed in space-time. So you've got this Planck length or this grain. Now, since in general, surface area, like I said, since surface area is less than its volume, right? If you think of a surface of a beach ball, that surface area of the ball is much smaller than the interior volume, right? So, but the thing is, but you're also, each grain on the surface corresponds to a point on the inside. So imagine you take this beach ball and you put dots all around it. Each dot would map to a much bigger dot inside the ball, right? Because you could fit, if you fit 100 dots on the outside, it would fit a trillion similarly sized dots on the inside. So these dots have to be bigger on the inside. You see what I'm saying? This is the key concept here. So this is what Hogan realized. He figured that if we had a measuring instrument detailed enough, we could potentially see the pixels or grain or Planck length of space-time, because the holographic version of them in the universe would be much bigger than they really are on the surface.
So is the Planck length, by the way, the Planck length is the bigger dot on the inside of the universe?
No, the Planck,
it's both.
It's kind of both, but the true Planck length is that figure I said, 1.6 times 10 to the minus 36 meters, impossibly small. But since we are potentially, you know, living in this holographic projection, it's kind of blurry. It's like a lower res version of what's the two-dimensional surface of the cosmological horizon. So that's the real size, which we could never see, but because we might be this projection, it's kind of a blurry, bigger image, because you're corresponding a tiny Planck length on the surface to a bigger unit of volume in three-dimensional space, much bigger, as a matter of fact. Maybe 10 to the minus 16 meters is one measurement I saw being thrown around. So a really cool thing is that Hogan, this guy is so sharp that he predicted, he was thinking, all right, what measuring instruments are sharp enough, are detailed enough to see this? And he realized that the GEO-600 gravity wave detector would be sensitive enough. And he predicted, because they're so sensitive, they might be getting noise, the actual quantum convulsions from space-time in their measurements, and he got in touch with them, and that's exactly what they had. They actually sent him a plot of the noise that they were seeing, and it matched his predictions.
Wow.
So there's one other bit of evidence that I thought was fairly compelling. It's not just the black hole evidence that seems to work with the event horizon. It's not just Hogan's predictions. There's another theorist named Juan Maldacena. He actually somehow he created a hypothetical universe. I don't know what it consisted of, whether it was software or not, but he made a hypothetical universe of five dimensions, and the physics inside it matched the physics on the four-dimensional boundary. So the fact that he was able to do that actually gives a little credence, you know, to what we're saying here. So in his model, the particles that interact on the surface corresponded exactly with the interacting strings on the interior. So because he was able to do that hypothetically, it makes you think that, well, okay, maybe, you know, there might be something to this, and I think it's worth pursuing. But remember, the bottom line is that no one knows if this is true yet. Most scientists consider this more of an idea or a hypothesis than a theory. And as a matter of fact, it's really a double-edged sword. If it's true, we may never see gravity waves because the resolution of the universe is too low to detect them. But on the other hand, of course, you know, it could help with determining quantum gravity. And one great quote I found here said that ultimately we may have our first indication of how space-time emerges out of quantum theory. So this could be really huge. And if it starts panning out, we will definitely see some Nobel Prizes being thrown around. So check out my blog on Friday.
Okay, what the hell? Who comes up with this stuff? Who comes up with this stuff? Come on.
Joe Bag of Donuts.
I mean, really, this, I mean...
All right, Joe.
It's mind-numbing. It's mind-numbing.
Bob, as soon as I figure out what you were talking about, you're going to blow my mind. I can't wait to hear this episode. Three times.
Michio Kaku is having a hard
time. Yeah, I wonder, does this tie in with string theory at all? Are these completely independent lines of thought?
Actually, there are some connections with string theory and M theory, and the other good thing that may come of this is that if this is actually shown to be likely, then it could actually be used to say, all right, these quantum theories do not include these quantum gravity theories do not include the holographic principle, so we can exclude them. And these string theories, you know, these versions of string theory and M theory do include it. So they're more likely we'll retain them, and they're more likely to be true. So yeah, it does. There is a connection.
Steve, this isn't actually string theory. This is called dental floss theory.
Mental floss theory.
And I guess the next thing to think about is, why is the universe built this way?
Because some spaceship is projecting us in a holodeck right now.
Computer and program.
Good one. Evan, that's a good one. Every now and then you got to say that just to check it out.
Does this support the Matrix theory of reality?
Did you just say the Matrix theory? Like the theory that we're all just...
living in a matrix.
Batteries for robots?
Of course. Where the hell have you been, Rebecca? All right, so but Bob, let me ask you a question. How does this advance the human race?
The projection of the human race, the hologram.
You never know what's going to come of things. What's that quote when J.J. Thomson discovered the electron? There was some big...
holy shit.
No, there was some... at some big science physics dinner or whatever, people were saying, you know, to J.J. Thomson's electron, may nothing come of it whatsoever. You know, of course, now our entire the world economy is based on electrons. You never know what's going to come out of it. And who cares? Just the thrill of discovery, you know, discovering the fundamental aspects of the universe. I mean, if that doesn't get you off, then I don't know.
Right. Now, that story reminds me of the story of the cosmic background radiation, where the radio astronomers couldn't get rid of this background noise, and it turns out that was the leftover noise from the Big Bang, and the profile of that noise matched predictions of the Big Bang, and it all kind of ties together in a similar
kind
of way.
Yeah, that was a really interesting analogy. That was I kept thinking of that while I was researching this, that it's very similar. You got this background noise, don't know what it is. I remember they went into their telescope and they're cleaning out the bird crap and trying to make it, and they're still there. And finally, they realize. I mean, they got Nobels out of this, and we learned so much. It really reinforced the Big Bang, and all sorts of great stuff came out of it. So
we're going to have to revisit this whole concept of the holographic universe. Maybe if we could wrangle a physicist onto the show to talk to us about it, we might be able to delve into it a little bit deeper.
Absolutely.
But I think I got the basic idea.
You don't get it, though, Steve? I mean, I totally get it. You don't understand this?
I mean, I understand what Bob said. It's hard to know how that sort of plugs into the whole construct of quantum mechanics and theoretical physics. That's interesting about the Planck length, because that's, again, when you understand the basics, like the college level of quantum mechanics, the Planck length is everywhere in quantum mechanics. Everything seems to always reduce down to the Planck length. It seems to be a fundamental building block of reality, and yet there isn't really any theory as to why that would be. This seems like the first step towards figuring that out. Why there is that? That's where the word quantum comes from. That the universe is not analog.
It's discrete, right?
You can only get down to this minimum quantum of stuff of space time. Why is that? I don't know. I think when we understand that, we'll get a much better handle on the whole quantum mechanical
thing. Yeah, and
thing.
You mentioned the Planck length, Steve. It's the value of Planck length is derived from constants such as the speed of light, Planck's constant, and the gravitational constant.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're deriving it from that. So if the foundation is strong, then so is that.
All right. Well, let's bring this back down to Earth a little bit. We're going to talk about the intelligent design and academic freedom in Louisiana and Texas. As we've discussed previously, the latest strategy of the intelligent design movement, after they failed to get intelligent design forced into public schools, they had an epic legal failure with the Dover trial a couple of years ago. Their next strategy was academic freedom, trying to get freedom for teachers to teach controversial theories or to criticize evolution or to use material that is not the official recognized material for their school system. And they have now been successful in getting just such a law passed in Louisiana. This was passed by the state's Board of Elementary and Secondary Education, and this is the Louisiana Science Education Act. Casey Luskin, who is one of the chief propagandists for the Discovery Institute, which is that intelligent design, quote-unquote, think tank, characterized the bill as a victory for Louisiana students and teachers. So if he likes it, it has to be bad. Essentially what the law says is, again, as I said, so teachers have the freedom to use other texts. Now, if you didn't have the context and you just read this law, it seems fairly innocuous. And then again, that has been the arc of the intelligent design creationism strategies, is to make their efforts from a legal point of view more and more innocuous so that they can pass legal muster. But the purpose is always the same. They're trying to crack open the door into science classrooms, and then once that door is cracked open, they will shove as much pseudoscience and anti-evolution propaganda and creationism through that crack as they can. That's the goal. In this particular case, what they're trying to do is open that door for their alternative science texts. They have the Discovery Institute publishes a book called Explore Evolution, which is chock full of nonsense and anti-evolution and anti-evolution pseudoscience. And that is the text that they want teachers to use. And this law was crafted to give teachers cover for using these kinds of pseudoscientific texts in their science classrooms. Interestingly, there was in the wrangling and the fighting back and forth over this law, previously in one version of it, there was language saying that the teaching of intelligent design was specifically prohibited. But proponents of the law pressured the board to remove those caveats in early December. And now the law has been passed without any caveats at all. So this, unfortunately, is a legal victory for the intelligent design buffoons, and we'll have to see how this plays out. The probably nothing can happen until the bill actually gets applied. Just the bill itself doesn't say anything that is probably illegal, because it doesn't say you have to teach religious belief or anything that could be construed as religion. It's really just how it gets applied. So this unfortunately is a loss for the good guys.
Well, yeah, what we need is for somebody to start teaching intelligent falling in school as opposed to gravity, and then send it back and so they can work out something that doesn't sound completely ridiculous, or that doesn't right. allow these idiots to pass off their stupid religion as science.
Right. I mean, this is the next phase that we've been discussing, and again, the key intellectual malfunction here is that they're confusing academic freedom with academic standards. Right, the whole purpose of having a curriculum and improved text and whatnot is to maintain some kind of standards. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that teachers can't be free to explore within those boundaries and to try to use methods based upon their own experience and their professionalism. That's fine, but they can't hijack the curriculum of the school in order to teach religious belief as science. And that's what this law is. Really, the purpose of it is to give teachers cover who want to do that. Similar kind of fighting going on in Texas, although it seems that things are going better there for the good guys. Just today, there has been testimony before the school board in terms of approving the new science standards, and they have been actually dramatically improved over the previous set of standards. Now, the fight in this case is over whether or not to include in the standards the provision to allow for the teaching of the strengths and weaknesses of scientific theories, specifically evolution. So here, this is again kind of under the academic freedom rubric, but they're taking a slightly different linguistic tact here, just trying to say that scientific standards should expressly include the teaching of the strengths and weaknesses of specific theories. Of course, this is just another way to crack open the door. What they're trying to do is then say that their text, their Explore Evolution, is specifically allowed because it's teaching the weaknesses of evolutionary theory, and the law requires that the strengths and weaknesses of scientific theories be taught. So again, it's all deceptive. It's all completely deceptive, and it's just these attempts to crack open the door so they could shove their bullshit through. But that text, the strengths and weaknesses provision, has been removed, and now that's what they're debating about. But hopefully, if the current version goes through without the strengths and weaknesses text, then that will be a victory for science in Texas. But again, we have to see how that plays out. Let's move on to some of your questions and emails. The first question was sent to us over Facebook. And actually, we don't have the name of the person who sent it at the moment. But this is a question about just asking us what we thought about a specific news article on sexual pheromones, myth or reality. And Jay, you read up on this one.
Yeah, I thought this was interesting. I mean, my gestalt reaction to pheromones was I was pretty sure that humans, like, you know, had some type of communication happening with pheromones, or like we could pick up those kind of signals just like other animals or whatever. You know, it's one of those things that just kind of enters your head by osmosis from being alive, right? Just hear about things about it, you know, pheromones and all that. But it turns out that some scientists were doing research on it, and they really can't find anything that concludes or proves that pheromones exist in humans. Pheromones definitely do exist in nature, but it's not been proven in humans at all. Now, there are some things that we know of. Like a really cool example would be that like a nursing infant would turn towards their mother's the mother's lactating breast without seeing it. Like they would probably be able to smell it somehow. I mean, I don't think they have any other theories on that, but the scent molecules in some way or another would drive a response. And, you know, obviously we have responses to smells. You know, smells are mm-hmm. closely associated to our memory, and, you know, pleasant and unpleasant smells can get a very strong reaction out of us. But, you know, pheromones are kind of the, like, invisible things that people would say that we would respond to. And, you know, there's always like the mating type of thing that people are trying to sell on the internet. You know, we use this liquid, which is pheromones, and drive the women crazy and all that stuff. Well, these scientists said they can't find anything. And one of the leading scientists' name was Wyatt. And he said, as far as releasers go, it may be that we simply don't have them. Oh, and he explains that a releaser pheromone triggers a behavioral response. And the other kind of pheromone, called a primer pheromone, is supposed to cause a physiological change. So he said, as far as releaser pheromones go, they don't think that we have them. When they study the historical evidence, they say that the research shows that
at the same time that our primate ancestors gained color vision, that they also lost the genes for, or the organ receptor, the organ that can pick up pheromones. So it's pretty interesting. It's, in my mind, I'm just looking at it as like just something else that I believe that was actually untrue so far with the current research, that just no proof that pheromones work in human beings.
Yeah, this is a genuine controversy, and that has not yet been resolved. There are definitely still people on both sides. There is some tantalizing evidence. Probably the best case that could be made for pheromones having a physiological effect in humans is the synchronization of female menstrual cycles through some kind of a hormonal, remote hormonal effect. So that's probably the best established one. There's certainly nothing established that would attract the opposite sex, which of course is what the market of pheromones is based upon. That's all BS. In fact, one theory of if there is a pheromone in humans, one theory is that the purpose of them is not to attract members of the opposite sex, but in order to tighten the emotional bonds between an intimate couple, that you really only pick up the pheromones through intimacy. You already have to be intimate with somebody, and it's more of a pair bonding, reinforcing phenomenon than a let me attract everyone of the opposite sex who's out there, which makes sense, if we shifted to a pair bonding basically type of lifestyle, that we would lose any kind of advertising or signaling that would promote promiscuity or threaten the pair bonding relationship. So another aspect of this I discovered when I was reading up on this too, Jay, was that, as you say, that we may not have the receptors, and we don't in the nose anymore, to pick up on the pheromones. Some researchers have found, for example, fMRI effects in the brain in response to certain pheromones, but at sub-threshold levels, so that people couldn't consciously smell anything, but there was still apparently some effect that was measurable in the brain. That's the kind of thing that definitely needs to be replicated. That's very tricky research to do. But so far, that's what the evidence is showing. So there's probably something going on. It's definitely not as strong as in many other animals. And it's probably not what the perfume manufacturers would want us to believe, that you could, as you say, put on something that smells good and it would drive the opposite sex wild. Let's go on to the one more email. This one comes from Chris Gerard in Cambridge, UK, and he writes, "Hi, everyone. A jolly good morning to the Skepchaps and the Skepchick from Chile, England. Every now and again, there's a story about dyslexia like this." Then he provides a link to a BBC article. "There are a few people who argue that it's a non-existent condition and that it's just about how well children are taught in their early years. Does this occur in the U.S. too? What's the SGU skinny on this?" Well, this is yet another topic where there's a lot of controversy about whether or not the phenomenon really exists, dyslexia. But this one, the story is actually much more clear. Dyslexia essentially is a recognized learning disorder or neurological development disorder that involves poor reading ability. Now, you guys have probably all heard, again, like through osmosis, you pick up the common lay conception of what dyslexia is, which again is almost always wrong, that people reverse the letters in words or reverse words. And that actually is a complete myth. That has nothing to do with reality.
What? Really?
Yeah. There's no reversing or anything.
The hell? Wow.
But that doesn't mean that dyslexia is not real. What dyslexia is a set of neurological disorders that result in impaired reading. In order to read, your brain needs to be able to do a couple of things. One is that it needs to be able to look at multiple letters at once and at a glance essentially put together the details of multiple letters into words and even groups of words. And it also needs to have the processing that essentially understands how to build words out of sounds. And those are two, in addition to other things as well, those are two things that have been identified that may not be functioning well in different children who have dyslexia. So the classical, for the last 10 or 20 years or so concept was that it was a problem with phonemes, with understanding that words are made up of sounds. And those who have had children who, have learned to read, it's interesting, especially like as a neurologist, watching my children learn how to do various things such as reading, because you actually can see them at the different stages of their neurological development and what they can do. And then it's like flipping a switch when they can do a new bit, right? They can do a new thing. So initially, when children are reading words, they read the sounds, but they don't know how to put the sounds together in a word. Like I would say d-a-g, but they can't go from d-a-g to dog. That connection is just not being made. And then they start to make that connection, and their reading takes off. And then suddenly D-O-G is not D-O-G, it's dog, right? Dyslexic children, some dyslexic children never make that leap. They never make that connection. So they have a reading problem that persists. Now, you can compensate for it. You can try to learn how to do it essentially the hard way. And with a lot of things in neurology, there's dedicated cortex that is optimized for a specific task. But you can sort of kind of do the task with other parts of your brain too, just not very well. So you can teach children with dyslexia to read, and there are specific strategies that have evolved, especially over like phonemic learning strategies, that can get them literate, can get them reading, but they're never going to be great readers. You know, it's always going to be a little bit more of a struggle for them than it would be for someone who doesn't have dyslexia. Also, it's important to recognize that dyslexics may also have other learning disabilities. It's not just about reading. There may be other learning disabilities that go along with it. So even if they do achieve literacy, that doesn't mean that their learning ability is up to average or normal. Some people, however, cast doubt on the existence of dyslexia, not really within the mainstream neurological community by my experience, but more among politicians or whatnot or educators who say that, well, if you take a bell curve of human variation in any trait, you can always call the bottom 5% or 10% of that bell curve as a disorder. So it's not really a disease or something different. It's just these are the bottom 10% of reading ability, children with reading ability, and it's not really fair to call that a disorder. Then you sort of get into semantics. Sure, even if it is just the bottom 10%, if they can't do something which is generally considered to be an ability that most people have, and it's something that actually would impair their ability to function in modern society, it's reasonable to say it's a disorder to the extent that they may need extra resources to try to get them to learn better to read, for example, without, getting into the semantic argument. It comes down to the argument of, do these kids need special resources or not? And I think the answer to that is clearly yes. Now, for some reason, this becomes like a political hot button issue. From what I understand, it comes up more frequently in the UK than it does in the US, although I still even hear it over here. In this case, there was a BBC article quoting Graham Stringer, who's a member of parliament, and he described dyslexia as a quote-unquote cruel fiction. And he said this was made up by educators to explain away their failure to teach some students how to read. But that is nonsense. That is a complete fiction. That's just rewriting history. This is not something that was just made up by educators. There's actually a very mature neurological discipline around the concept of dyslexia. It fits with our understanding of how the brain works, how reading works as a neurological function, and there's actually a vast literature exploring what's actually neurologically different about children who express dyslexia, and we're finding that there are different subsets depending on different parts of the brain that aren't functioning as well. And so it's you have to be ignorant of all of that to just write this off as a fiction invented by educators. So that's just an ignorant statement, unfortunately. Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Alice Tuff. Alice, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Thank you for inviting me to be here.
And Alice is the development officer for a British group called Sense About Science. And they are a group of young scientists who try to teach good science to the public. So, Alice, why don't you first start by just telling us about your group, how it got formed, your involvement with it. What do you guys do?
Sure. We're a UK-based charity, and our remit is to promote good science and evidence to the public. And what that means is we work with scientists to try and respond to sort of misleading claims about science. We also try and look at, try and explain some of the scientific process and give people sort of tools to sort through some of the claims they come across and try and sort fact for fiction. We were basically set up about 5 years ago by Lord Tverne, and it sort of came out of a debate in the House of Lords, where after all the problems in the UK with MMR and BSE, it was felt that science wasn't really being communicated very well, and it was also felt that scientists were often missing for the arguments. So they wanted to do something about it. So we were set up basically to respond directly to the public, work for the public, but work with scientists to do this.
So you were established by the British government?
Not by the British government, by Lord Tverne. He's in the House of Lords.
Oh, okay.
And he and a few other senior scientists at the time felt that this was an issue, and they wanted to do something about it.
Okay, and it says that you're a charitable trust. What exactly does that mean? Is that the equivalent, like in the United States, you would say a non-profit organization? Is that the same thing?
Yeah, so we're basically a charity, non-profit.
So what are some of the major issues that you have dealt with recently?
More recently, we've been doing things on detox for celebrities, but we've covered a whole range of subjects. One of the first things we looked at was chemicals, because we had quite a few scientists coming to us who were quite concerned about the kind of anti-chemical mentality there was at the time. So, and there's a lot of misconceptions around this, so it's sort of ideas that you can lead a chemical-free lifestyle, man-made chemicals, inherently dangerous, things like that. And they wanted to respond to some of this and try and give people some of the understanding about what the distinction is between natural and man-made chemicals and why just because a chemical's been linked to something doesn't mean it necessarily causes it. So we've done a lot of work in that area. We've also done work in weather and climate, radiation, and more recently work looking at patient groups and patients who are not getting access to information about different treatments.
You mean like dubious treatments or just standard medical treatments?
Dubious treatments. So what we found is we had quite a few patient groups coming to us who were quite concerned because there's a lot of this stuff on the web and also on patient forums. They felt that some of these companies were posing as patients to try and sell some of their products. And they were getting a lot of calls about this from patients who didn't really know what the evidence behind the treatment was, whether to pursue these treatments. So they wanted to sort of put together something to help people sort of work through some of the information they come across. So it's giving insights like what peer review is, what clinical trials are, and what to look for in a treatment to see whether it's evidence-based or not.
Is most of the work that you do essentially writing for venues on the internet, or what other kind of things do you do?
Most of our publications are disseminated to a mixture of people. So we basically work with anybody who's an intermediary, which means it can anyone who basically is in contact with the public, which ranges from MPs to patient groups to teachers, civic intermediaries, a real range of people, and we basically disseminate the information through them. So, for example, with the patient guide, that went out to all the patient groups, medical research charities, doctors, midwives, nurses, all the people who are going to be speaking to patients about these issues.
And that went out like in the form of a pamphlet?
Yeah, so it's a short thing. It's called I've Got Nothing to Lose by Trying It. And it basically just works through some of the things. So, for example, it talks about why do unproven therapies seem to work? What's the role of clinical trials? Medicine and news, is it real hope or hype? How to distinguish between different treatments, whether it's something that's just been linked. So, for example, you get headlines that say this has been linked to Alzheimer's. So it's helping people sort through, is there actually an issue there? Should I be worried about this? Or is it just that at the moment it's just been linked to it?
Alice, you also released a Science for Celebrities pamphlet, which I recently found, and I enjoyed that thoroughly. It basically just has quotes from about science from celebrities, followed by quotes by scientists describing why they're wrong. I was really impressed that the pamphlet even had a number. You offer a number to call to talk to a scientist. I thought that was a really good idea. Do you find a specific celebrity to be especially irritating?
We always find there's a few that pop up quite regularly. So, for example, in the UK, there's a nutritionist called Ginny McKeith, and she's popped up the last couple of years. And there's also a lady called Carol Kaplan, who's been giving sort of dodgy diet advice. And 18th cent come up quite often. But we've actually been quite impressed this year. It's been fantastic because it's actually getting better. What we've noticed is, because it's our third year of doing it, is that in certain areas it seems to be improved. So, for example, celebrity chefs seem to have got the idea a bit better and they're making less outrageous claims about nutrition. And generally, on the whole, it is getting better.
Have you taken on the MMR scare directly? I'm sure you have. That's probably a big issue for you.
That was one thing we, I think, dealt with slightly when we first set up. But we actually do refer to it in a recent celebrities document, because there's been quite a lot, I know, over in the US. There's been quite a few politicians speaking out about this, and also a few celebrities. So we actually touched upon some of these points in the document itself and just got scientists to respond to it.
And do you think that you're having an impact? Are you being well received? And do you do anything to try to measure that at all?
In a sense, the science of celebrities, what we've noticed is, like I said, it tends to be getting better. There are fewer examples now. And we're also getting more requests for help to consult scientists, which is fantastic. Because that's what we wanted to do. We really wanted to send a message just to check their facts before they speak out. And that there are scientists out there who are quite happy to help them and give them advice on these things.
So a lot of what you do, it sounds like, is just a conduit between the mainstream scientific community and any kind of public media.
It's partly working as a conduit and supporting scientists to get out there and speak about these issues and make sure the public has access to science. But it's also about explaining how science works. So we've done a lot of work talking about peer review. And when we set out to do this, everybody was quite shocked. Like, why peer review? You know, that's not very interesting. People won't find it helpful. And actually, we've produced a short guide, I Don't Know What to Believe, Making Sense of Science Stories. And it just goes through sort of the basic principles of what peer review is, how you can use it to sort of weigh up whether something's published or unpublished research, what that means. And it's one of our most popular publications to date. It's had something like over 150,000 copies downloaded. And it's a real range from teachers to MPs, and they're all using it and finding it a really useful tool.
Now, when you describe all of the things that you do, I'm struck by the similarity to what we do, because we have the same mission, essentially, though we go about it slightly differently. So, but we, in the United States, we call what you do and what we do skepticism, or the skeptical movement. Is that a term that you've used to describe yourselves, or do you see any similarities or differences to the skeptical movement?
I can see, I've definitely heard the term used, skepticism. I think it's quite a good description, because what it really is encouraging people to ask questions. So a lot of what we do is partly myth-busting, but also encouraging people to start thinking about these things. So, for example, the work with the young scientists looking at product claims, one of the things that they really wanted to come out of it was to raise awareness with people that sometimes these claims aren't backed up by evidence, and that also anyone can ask these questions. Anyone can ring up a company and ask them for the evidence behind their claims.
But what do you find is the attitude in the UK towards skepticism in general? Is there a sense of negativity about the word or about people who self-identify as skeptics, do you think? And is that a term that you specifically didn't use to describe your group, or it wasn't even on the radar?
I don't think it was even on the radar, but I think definitely the skepticism had negative connotations originally. But I actually think, and partly due to things like your organization and also the wider blogging and podcasting community, I think it has become quite an accepted term these days. I don't think people really have a problem with it. I think it's seen as much more positive, seen as much more having the knowledge to sort of really query these claims and really sort of question things.
That's exactly how I feel about it. Initially, people thought they were cynical and had a negative connotation, but now it is getting, people are feeling better about it.
I think people have got the distinction between cynicism and skepticism, which I think was slightly confused in people's minds before, as I think people see them now as two very different things.
Yeah, I think we've made some progress on the PR front. I wanted to ask you about a couple of specific issues that you've addressed. I know you, on your website, it discusses the fact that you personally did an investigation of homeopaths prescribing treatments for malaria. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is basically, I came to Sense About Science as an intern originally, and one thing that had come up was this concern that homeopaths were giving advice about anti-malaria prophylaxis. So I basically went in to find out what advice they were giving. And at the very start of the investigation, the first thing I did was go to a medical travel clinic and find out what information they would give. And it took a long time. It was very detailed. They talked about the different countries, the different options, and just went through everything in really sort of great detail. And one thing that struck me was the first time I walked into a homeopathic pharmacy, I went into them and asked whether they had any treatments I could use for malaria. They said yes. And I was like, oh, is it okay to take it? You know, does it work? And they were like, yes, yes, it's fine. And they actually advised me to stop taking my doctor's medication because I said I wasn't sure about taking it because I thought I was going to get side effects. They're like, no, no, it's fine. Don't worry about taking it. Take our stuff. And the whole transaction took something like 10 minutes. And I think that's what struck me more than anything. They didn't give any advice on side effects. They didn't give any advice on bite prevention, nothing like that. And just really, that comparison really was quite shocking.
And that's very different than the public face that the homeopaths present, right? I mean, they really try to present themselves as being more thorough and also not... they don't publicly admit that they will prescribe homeopathic remedies instead of proven medicines for definitive diseases like malaria. But you walk into their store, and they will. You find that disconnect?
Yes, and it was interesting, that part. I mean, there was a couple of exceptions where I did have slightly longer. I think I went to 10 in total. I think about two of them I had slightly longer consultations. But the rest of them were very much quick transactions. It was just a case of going in, asking for it. Yes, fine, no problem. Here's your money. Here's your pills. Off you go.
When you made that information public, what was the reaction that you got?
It was phenomenal, actually. It was Newsnight in the UK picked it up and did their own investigation and found it was the same thing happened, which they then released at the same time as we released our investigation. And what really hit home to me was a neighbour of my boyfriend's came up to me and said, oh, I'd been taking these and I hadn't realised that there wasn't a problem with them. I hadn't realised they wouldn't possibly work. And that really hit home to me that most people aren't necessarily aware of these things and how important it was to get out there that information.
Yeah, and it is striking as well, just the inherent deceptiveness of the whole endeavor. I mean, it's like they're hiding from the public what they're really claiming. It is amazing how few people, even still, despite our efforts, don't realize that homeopathic remedies contain nothing at all.
Exactly, and when you speak to most people, they think it's herbal medicine. They're like, oh, you know, it's just a sort of herbal, natural thing. And when you go through it, most people I find are very shocked at exactly what homeopathy is, the fact there is nothing in it.
I think that that's similar to the broader alternative medicine movement also, that while, you know, in certain sectors, the spiritual energy, you know, aspect of it is very appealing, but in terms of the public face that they're trying to present, they try to make it seem more scientific and plausible, but then behind the curtain, it's just pure magical thinking. But there's, again, that screen of absolute deceptiveness in place. Do you find the same thing?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really important that people go to these things and ask the evidence behind it. And I think it's really important that people have access to finding out exactly what evidence is supporting these treatments. It's anyone's own choice whether they decide to pursue a treatment or not, but they need to have access to all the information and the evidence behind it.
You were also involved in the recent push against the detox claims. What can you tell me about that?
Sure, that was basically another project by our young scientists, which is basically postdocs and PhDs. And they started looking into sort of pseudoscientific product claims last year, released something and invited others to join their cause. And more people started joining, and one thing that kept coming up was detox. And what they wanted to find out was when they looked around, detox was being used to describe everything from teas to tonics to hair straighteners. And this seemed implausible. So they wanted to find out what evidence the company had for their claims and what they meant by detox. What they found was that every company, or most companies, had different definitions of the word detox. And most of them had little or no evidence to support the claims. And even worse, a lot of them were making misleading claims about the body. So there was this trend, this idea that somehow toxins build up in you, you need to purge it. You can boost your liver and kidney to cleanse these toxins and chemicals. So they did two things. They released the results of their product investigation, the detox dossier, and they also produced a leaflet explaining how the body works and the fact that the body is the best thing you can have. Your liver and kidneys will do the job, which they've been releasing sort of all over the country, taking out into the public and handing it out.
Now, it sounds like from everything we've discussed so far, your activities are geared towards just educating the public about all of these topics, and certainly that's a huge task. But when you get into areas like alternative medicine and homeopathy, and you said like the use of the word detox, it's hard not to stray into issues of government regulation. Is that something that you guys deal with? Do you have a position on like how things like this should be regulated, or do you try to stay as apolitical as possible?
We don't really deal in regulation, and partly that's because we feel that one of the most effective tools is actually to raise this kind of social and cultural awareness of asking these questions. So, for example, on the products thing, one thing that came out of it last year was people like, oh, you know, how do you, what do you do with these products? Can you report them? Yes, there are a few organizations you can report them to, but there's also a lot of gray areas. So, for example, products that are sold on the internet, no one really regulates them. And for everyone that you an organization could take down, more will pop up. So what's better, I think, in a lot of these cases, to actually raise this kind of social awareness that the claims on these products are wrong and that people should question them.
And there are also some topics, and I see that you deal with them, you know, on your website, that at least in the United States are heavily political. It's hard, even among scientists and skeptics, you bring up certain topics and you know, people's political sensibilities flare up. One topic, which it's from our perspective, seems to be even more of a controversy in Europe than it is in the United States, is genetically modified food. Has Sense About Science taken a position on that, or what information do you think is most salient about the way the public thinks about GM food?
I think the problem with GM food is there's a lot of misconceptions, and I think scientists were quite slow to react initially, and that's one of the reasons our organisation was sort of started. That was another thing at the time, was felt that scientists weren't really getting out there and getting involved in the debate. We're actually doing some work at the moment on this, we're releasing something on this in a couple of months, and we're basically looking at kind of what the misconceptions are around GM, and a lot of it seems the fact that people think it's a new technology, concerns about the health, when actually the evidence is very different from what's been reported in the media. So it's something we're hoping to work on and get out there.
Like, so what are some of the main misconceptions that the public has about GM food?
I think one of them is definitely the idea it's a new technology. Most people don't see selective breeding and see the fact that GM is actually a refined version of this. So people don't look at it and see that we've actually been changing and mutating crops and different things to get what we want and the best sort of production for years. GM is essentially just a very refined tool where you can actually minimize the risk of other mutations, and people don't really have that understanding.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, we've been doing it for thousands of years. You know, pretty much everything we eat has been drastically altered from the way it existed in nature prior to human meddling.
Exactly. The cows you see today, the big fat heifers in the fields, are very different from the skinny things that existed thousands of years ago. And I think most people aren't really aware of that, and they see them as completely separate things.
And the other topic, just again looking at the list of things that you specifically mentioned on your website that strikes me as a very political one, is weather and climate change. Is that something that you guys have dealt with directly?
What we've been doing is we've been working with weather and climate scientists who are worried that people are getting slightly confused between the distinction between weather and climate predictions. So, for example, weather forecasts are based on probability of certain events happening, but climate's over time. So you'll get a one-off weather event, which is maybe ascribed to global warming, when actually it's part of a long-term process. So we've been basically working with scientists to explain how they do the modelling, how weather and climate differentiates, and also what causes extreme weather events.
Mm-hmm. So again, you just try to educate the public about like the difference between climate and weather, and so they could think about and understand the issue, but you haven't really taken a position on whether or not you think anthropogenic global warming is scientific and legitimate or not.
And we basically will always state where the evidence is. So we work with community scientists across the range, and we'll say the evidence is here at this point. So we don't really take a position. We always just say where the science and evidence is.
And what is your opinion on that? And also, just in general, do you think what do you think the public opinion is in the UK about man-made global warming?
I think most people feel it's actually a real and present effect. I think one of the big debates at the moment is gearing the country up to deal with it. So one of the concerns at the moment is that we're not looking enough at things like flood defences and looking around at the wider sort of what impacts this is going to have on the actual country and what resources need to be put in place to be able to deal with this.
And is there a political party or faction in the UK that generally is skeptical or doubtful of man-made global warming, or is it accepted across the political spectrum?
I would say it's accepted across the political spectrum, and I think it's obviously a hot topic these days in campaigns. Everybody wants to be seen as to be doing something about it, so it's quite kind of a media-savvy thing to be really sort of supportive. So I think most of them are fully on board with it.
Well, Alice, we really appreciate having you on The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
I hope we can have you back sometime in the future. And I also, it looks like that there's so much overlap between what our groups do. We should talk about collaboration in the future.
Yeah, it'd be fantastic. We're actually looking to set up some international aspects to our work. So what we're not going to attempt to replicate ourselves in other countries, but we'd like to work with other organisations to share some of our work and way of doing it. And it's something that's sort of in the process at the moment. So it'd be fantastic to talk to you a bit more about it once we've got something more set in place.
Well, good talking with you. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
And now, Randy speaks.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, as the case may be. I'm James Randy. When I get into discussions about whether or not there's any real science being used in the art known as parapsychology, and it is an art involving a lot of sleight of mind, I often provide this parallel. Don't ever think that just because a specialized vocabulary has been developed for a variety of ology, such as parapsychology, that it necessarily has a factual basis just for that reason. Here's another example. Take the medieval notion known as transubstantiation. For those of you who are not up on religious mythology, I'll explain what that's supposed to be. When the ceremony slash ritual slash performance known as communion is conducted in some churches, two props are in evidence, bread and wine. Now, what's supposed to be bread is hardly what we'd recognize as that commodity. It consists of a small, thin wafer of some sort. But the wine used is the real thing, though usually with just a soupçon that it may become vinegar at any moment. But here's the truth of the matter. The devout parishioners who partake of the communion ceremony are asked to believe, and probably do believe, that a magical transubstantiation has occurred, transforming the wine into blood and the bread into flesh. No, I'm serious. They're taught that this rather inferior bread and wine material has been miraculously transformed into the actual flesh and blood of Jesus Christ. Now, I apologize if this is a rude surprise to you. It certainly was to me, and I need hardly tell you that I rejected the notion immediately. And getting back to what's supposed to be science, here's the parallel I'm trying to make. Take the word psychokinesis, meaning movement by psychological means, as a good example. That's a commonly used expression in the woo-woo world of parapsychology, which word by itself means parallel with psychology. It's a widely held delusion by some people that they or other gifted persons can cause small objects to move or even change in substance. Folks, the fact that a name has been invented to describe this, even though it's formed from real Latin derivatives, doesn't make it any more real than transubstantiation, or the Tooth Fairy, or Sylvia Brown's year-end predictions. Much the same sort of reasoning can be applied to the parapsychologists themselves. Now, there are two different sorts of parapsychologists. One kind goes through life constantly deceiving themselves, making excuses and rationalizations for failures, and yet turning out many books and papers on their work, always promising further progress if only sufficient funding were to be provided. And that usually follows because there are lots of wishful thinkers out there with money. The other kind of parapsychologist spends some time at it, then looks at the evidence more closely and opts to take up another profession. Sterling examples of this reversal can be found in Dr. Susan Blackmore and Dr. Chris French, UK scientists who saw the train wreck they could have become part of, but left the track in time to avoid the inevitable collision with the real world. In fact, both Duke University and Stanford in the USA gave up their many years of involvement in parapsychology simply because they had no positive results to support their continued involvement. And the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, known as PEAR, the PEAR Lab, closed down operation just recently after almost 30 years in business, and for the same reason. In many cases, parapsychologists will be PhDs, a most exalted academic position. But many such folks make the presumption that once they've earned that distinction, they can't be fooled. Because they think logically and in a straightforward, linear manner, they're much easier to deceive than they think they are. You see, an electron, a cell, a crystal, will always do the same thing when subjected to the same forces, within limitations, of course. But when the human element enters the equation, the possibility of purposeful deception or self-deception is present. And any magician will tell you that he or she would much rather take on the task of fooling, for entertainment purposes, of course, a learned adult rather than a child. The reason for that is not intuitive at all. The fact is that a child is not smart enough, not sufficiently experienced with the real world to be easily deceived. I'm James Randi.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a slightly different version this week. I'm going to read you four items. These are not news items. These are facts that I pulled out of a book. I'll tell you what that book is when we're done.
Wait, what if the book is the book of stupid made-up facts?
These are four facts. Three of these are true.
Normie, Steve. You can hear me.
And one of these is fake.
I know you can hear me.
Here we go. I'll tell you about the book after we're done. Here's fact number one. Coffee beans are not beans. They are seeds.
That's bullshit.
Item number two. Although sometimes used as a common name, there is no such thing as a panther in scientific classification. Item number three, bubbles form in champagne by carbon dioxide condensing on imperfections in the glass. And item number four, flamingos in the wild get their pink color mainly from eating blue-green algae.
Oh, man.
And Rebecca, since you're about to fall asleep, I'll let you go first.
Coffee beans are called coffee beans for a reason, Steve. I'm a little suspicious that they might not actually be beans, but seeds. The idea that there's no such thing as a panther, I've heard something similar, I think, that maybe panther is just a black jaguar or wildcat or mountain lion, I think that's what it is. But yeah, it's just a word that we have for a black version of some other cat. I do believe that the bubbles in champagne are mostly affected by the imperfections of glass. That does make sense. But flamingos in the wild, I always heard that they get their pink color not from blue-green algae, because that's stupid, because those are two completely different colors, but that they get their pink color from shrimp, which are pink. So I'm going to say that you made that up. Yeah, I guess that means that coffee beans aren't beans, that they are seeds. So yeah, I'm going with the last one. I think you made up that blue-green algae crap.
Okay, Evan?
Yeah, I'm having problems with this blue-green algae stuff, too. I'm not sure why, though. I don't buy the shrimp eating. And as far as the other three go, the coffee beans, actually seeds, makes very good sense to me. The panther? That's interesting. I've never heard that in any context before, so I don't know about that one. And the bubbles from champagne, carbon dioxide condensing on imperfections in the glass is, I guess, plausible. I'll have to agree with Rebecca and say the flamingos one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, I'm going to buy the coffee beans are not beans, that they're seeds. If you look at the shape of them, aren't they kind of like bifurcated, like a seed and not smooth like at least the beans that I eat? So that alone makes me think that they're actually seeds and not beans. Interesting. Let's see. The panther. Yeah, panther does sound kind of generic to me. I could buy that it's not a real scientific classification. and the bubbles forming in the champagne. I think most people have heard of that. The carbon dioxide finds these nucleation sites, these imperfections, and starts building the little bubbles on top of them until they're big enough to float away. So that leaves the flamingos. I guess I'm going to have to say that one is the fiction.
Okay, Jay.
The coffee beans are not beans. They are seeds. That is correct.
Didn't you say that was bullshit when it first came up?
Yeah, I did that to throw you off.
Yeah, well, it didn't work, did it?
It worked, yeah.
I actually remember, I think way back in science class when I was a kid, I remember this. But I don't quite remember what the significant difference is between a bean and a seed.
Well, a bean is actually the magical fruit. So the more you eat it, I've heard, the more you toot.
I think a bean grows in a pod, but okay, anyway, without getting into...
How did I not get a laugh over that? The magical fruit? Come on.
I'm laughing.
I'm
inside
laughing.
Yeah,
I'm laughing.
Go on.
I'm laughing back in history from like second grade.
The panther scientific classification one, I freakishly also think I remember something about this that wasn't, I didn't read the book, whatever book Steve read, I didn't read, but I'll get back to that one. The bubbles formed in champagne by carbon dioxide condensing on imperfections in the glass. That is absolutely correct, and I think most people know that. And the flamingos eating the algae, that is so cool. If that's what makes them pink, I love that. That's very cool. But I'm going to go with number two because I actually think I remember something to the contrary about that, as I think that is incorrect.
Okay. So, Jay, you're going with the panthers. Everyone else is going with the flamingos, right? Okay. So we'll start with number one. I'll tell you where these come from. These all come from the Book of General Ignorance. Everything you think you know is
General
wrong.
Ignorance. He used to be a major, right? And then
That's right. That's right. It was promoted by John Lloyd and John Mitchinson. And what it is a collection of things that are commonly believed but are wrong. And it's quite interesting. I have a lot of quibbles with it, though, and we'll talk about some of them in a minute.
Quibbles.
So as you might imagine, any type of book like that is going to, just opens up the door to pedantry. But anyway, so coffee beans are not beans. They are seeds.
That's true.
That is science. Beans specifically are any of various New World twinning herbs of the genus Phaseolus in the pea family. And it could refer to the seed or the pod or the plant, bean. Beans don't necessarily come in a pod. You can actually use the word bean to refer
string beans
to the pod in some cases. Like a string bean, right. String bean is the pod with the seeds in it. Whereas coffee beans are not related to that at all. They actually, the coffee beans are seeds, and when they grow, they are surrounded by a very intensely sweet fruit. And then that fruit, the coffee beans are inside. Remember we talked about civet coffee? Remember that word?
Yeah.
Recover the coffee beans from the poop of civets. That's because the civets eat the fruit.
Right.
The sweet fruit around it. Yeah.
That's why you see coffee beans when they pick them up. They could be red or green.
You all also agree that bubbles form in champagne by carbon dioxide condensing on imperfections in the glass. And that one is the fiction.
Whoa! What?
That's BS, Steve.
Are you saying you duped us all?
I did. I'm sorry. So it turns out...
No. This is all wrong. That book is BS.
I had to do my independent confirmation because I didn't buy a lot of stuff I read in this book either. But it turns out that the imperfections in the glass are too small to form condensation nuclei for the dissolved carbon dioxide in champagne.
So what is it? Is it dirt?
Actually
dirt!
It's dirt.
Oh, I remembered that then when you said it. Oh, damn.
It's dirt and dust and little bits
right when he said it.
In the champagne, but not the glass. But not
no, it's not
glass.
Like a little tiny
free floating
glass. I can't believe I... Oh!
Guess how many bubbles there are in an average bottle of champagne?
Maybe four.
3 million.
5 million.
250 million.
Wow. That's a lot of bubbles.
That's a lot of bubbles.
I met a stripper named Bubbles once, and damn,
yeah, she had a lot of.
So again,
these
were
dirt on her too.
these were tricky because they were all things that people commonly believe. So of course, this means that although sometimes used as a common name, there is no such thing as a panther in scientific classification. That is true.
Well, obviously, but the flamingos. Come on.
All right, we'll get there in a second. So the the panther thing is very interesting. Now, this is where, in my opinion, the book you know, it tries to emphasize the degree to which common beliefs are wrong by glossing over some of the.
Well, but isn't the word it's not actually the word panther, isn't it? Like a variation of the word panther. Is are they being that picky in the book?
The word panther just means beast, and it can be used to refer to any large cat. It does. It's not actually a genus or a species of large cat. There's no such thing in a way as a panther. However, I had to reformulate what they said because there actually is a Florida panther. Florida panther is a common name for a specific species. So that's why I said it's used as a common name but not as a scientific classification. They kind of glossed over that and just said there's no such thing as panthers.
I saw one on the highway.
Yeah, I've seen him in captivity when you know, we visited Florida.
This was in the wild. It was really cool. We were driving to Disney, and I see this huge black cat loping across the highway with that typical way cats move. It was gorgeous, and it was huge, huge, incredible.
Oh God, that thing could kill you so fast you wouldn't even know what happened.
Actually, Florida panthers are tan in color.
Yeah, but this one was a black panther, Steve.
Yes, you saw some. But black panthers are. Rebecca was correct. Black panthers. What you think of as a black panther is actually a leopard that has black on black spots.
Oh.
And if you look closely at them, you can actually see the leopard spots in the texture of the fur.
Very scary.
Have you ever seen that? Like at a zoo, have you ever seen that?
No. But
panthers are actually cougars, subspecies puma. So they're actually pumas.
Steve, what about Lion-O?
Lion-O was a lion human hybrid.
So, Bob, you saw a jaguar on the highway, so it's probably driving by very quickly.
I saw a big
Bob's
black
like,
cat
I saw a black jaguar. It had four-wheel drive. Oh, my God.
So, but that's I thought that was interesting.
I hate you for that. I hate this whole science or fiction segment.
Now,
I hate it.
Flamingos in the wild get their pink color mainly from eating blue-green algae.
That's
so true.
Stupid. How can blue-green algae cause pink flamingos?
Use your imagination.
I had to throw in two caveats that they excluded because they just said they don't get them from shrimp. But here's
popcorn
the full story.
Shrimp.
So there are four different species of flamingo. They eat a variety of things. They eat mainly blue-green algae. Some species do also eat crustaceans, you know, tiny crustaceans. That they filter through their mouth. What the book said was that they don't get the color at all from the quote-unquote shrimp that they eat, but actually that's not true. They do get some of the color from the shrimp, but they get it more from the blue-green algae, and they also get it from a lot of other things that they eat as well. It ultimately comes from the carotene, and this is why blue-green algae aren't pink or red and why crustaceans in the wild are not, in life, are not pink or red, because the carotene, which is a red pigment, is bound to proteins, and those proteins make them blue or green or some other color. But when you cook a shrimp, for example, you denature those proteins. So that's why when you cook a shrimp, it goes from white to red, because you're denaturing the proteins that are binding to the carotene, and that's releasing the color of the carotene.
Oh, wow, that's really cool.
In the flamingo, the carotene gets, again, decoupled from the proteins that are neutralizing its color and then gets incorporated into growing feathers, turning those feathers pink to red or crimson or something, depending on what they're eating. I also had to throw in the wild, because often flamingos in zoos are fed shrimp in order to make their coats pink. But in the wild, they mainly feed on blue-green
algae. Steve, that book sounds awesome.
It's fun, but I had to independently check things out. They did gloss over some of these details.
Wait, did you check every fact in the book?
No, just the ones that I was using tonight, you know, but in other ones out of interest, not everyone. But there was some, and a couple, I mean, there's a lot of things we would know about, like the 10% of the brain thing. Basically, any historical story you ever heard is a lie. You know, it's always the propaganda that later emerged is what we all know in public consciousness, but it's never what actually really happened. Anyway, it is a fun book, but you have to be skeptical of even the facts that they have.
Definitely.
In that book, which of course is a good thing.
Confirm, always confirm.
Evan,
who's that noisy?
Tell us the answer to last week's Who's That Noisy and Who Won?
All right, for those of you who missed it last week, here is the clip again.
Although there is nothing supernatural about it, I am willing to forfeit the sum of $1,000 to anyone who can prove that it is possible.
And that is, of course, the one and only Harry Houdini speaking about his water torture cell.
A lot of people got it.
Recorded. Yeah, a lot of people did get it. Well, you know, they cheaty Googled it, you know, cheaters.
Yeah, we're still dialing it in. You know, Evan is still trying to figure out how tough to make this. But that was cool to hear Harry Houdini.
In 1914.
And he has that voice that they had back then.
Yeah.
There's an accent, there's a temporal accent that you could always tell when...
Yeah, it also sounds corny.
Very staged.
To modern ears, it sounvery staged.
Very.
And next, I'm going to tell you that we have to do...
humanity. One listener emailed in and said that was James Randi, and he was like, I'm 100% correct. But if I'm wrong, completely ignore this email.
Randy's not that old.
Richard Socor from New York. First to guess
first.
Correctly. So congratulations,
well done,
Richard, and thanks for playing. Now, on to this week's Who's That Noisy? All right.
Who is it?
Can you identify this noise?
That's Rebecca saying, poop, poop, poop.
All right. So there you go.
No,
nothing to Google there, folks. So
I know, right?
So listen to it a couple times.
I typed bleep into Google, but it didn't come up with anything. Jay.
Yeah.
Do you have a quote for us this week?
I have three quotes this week.
Three?
Please Skype
three
them
to quotes?
Me.
Yes,
three
I have three.
Quotes? Pick one.
Three.
Wow.
All right. I'll start with Rebecca in London speaking at Skeptics in the Pub on Monday the 19th. And she said, excuse me, I just have snot.
It's true, I did say that, and I did have snot.
Rebecca Watson!
Jay picks the best quotes for the Rogues.
That was sent in by Chris Hillman. Thank you, Chris. You have
That's
no
inspiring.
Idea how much I appreciated that quote.
Very inspiring.
Excuse me, everybody, I just have
it's
snot.
It's true, it was going to go dripping on. I was very, very ill. For my talk. But
Rebecca is a very classy lady.
Well, I'm a professional, and I don't just drill snot on the microphone without letting everyone know.
Okay, my next quote, this somebody sent me a link for this. I'm totally sorry. In the wash of emails, I mixed up, and I don't know who it is, but check this out. This is Paris Hilton commenting about her going on Richard Branson's Virgin spaceflight, and apparently Paris Hilton is going to be on it. And she said, God, I can't believe this. She goes, I'm very scared to do it. What if I don't come back? With the whole light years thing, what if I come back 10,000 years later and everyone I know is dead? I'll be like, great, now I have to start all over.
Wow.
That's wrong on
That's
so many
really
levels.
Funny, yeah, actually. That was a good one.
All right, you lost me at Paris Hilton, so there we go.
Okay, and I'm not giving her a shout out because this next quote I have is from a book by Karl Popper. Karl Popper was an Austrian-British philosopher and a professor at the London School of Economics. And Karl wrote, the scientific tradition is distinguished from the pre-scientific tradition in having two layers. Like the latter, it passes on its theories, but it also passes on a critical attitude towards them. The theories are passed on, not as dogmas, but rather with the challenge to discuss them and improve upon them. Karl Popper! And that was sent in by Paul Southworth, and thanks for the quote, Paul.
Popper is the guy who essentially advanced the notion of empirical falsification
nice.
As critical to the scientific method.
Awesome.
Cool.
Now that's cool.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. Well, thank you everyone for joining me again this week. Rebecca, thanks for talking with us at 3 in the morning.
Isn't it like 4 in the morning now?
Thanks for joining me again, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.